Hello, hello.
It's going to be off by...
Nice. I didn't do it this time. I was cringing inside not doing it, and so you guys did the clap. Okay, so we did... First, we did the ideation one where we talked about how can we create an environment that makes it easy for us to come up with great ideas around problems that need to be solved. And then after the ideation one, what did we do next? The validation. Like, how do we validate that these ideas are actually good ideas to pursue? And then we did the MVP, which we decided the best insight, it's actually been used with my entrepreneurs that I mentor, is not calling it an MVP and then calling it a CSP, a crappy, smelly product. And the consensus is from everyone, just calling it a crappy, smelly product makes us more likely to put something out that's not perfect. Otherwise, you know, you run into that perfection is the enemy of complete type thing, right? So today, we are going to talk about pivoting. When it makes sense to pivot your idea, because, you know, if you imagine you've just built an MVP, you've got it out there, and now you have to make some pivots. So every founder falls in love with their first idea, but markets don't care about your feelings. The reality is most startups don't succeed with their first concept. It's probably a, like, 0.001% chance that your very first idea, your first MVP, just ends up being like, well, looks like we hit a home run here. Like, you're going to have to pivot, right? The startups that succeed because they pivoted. And so pivoting isn't weakness. It's the discipline of changing direction without changing your vision. And the innovators who win aren't the ones who never give up. They're the ones who know what to give up and when. So a thought experiment, just to kind of get us thinking about, think about a founder that treats her original idea like sacred ground. She spends years grinding, adding features, chasing investors, but users never bite. And then founder B notices that there's this one tiny feature that users love. She ditches the whole rest of the app, doubles down on that one feature, and turns it into an entirely new company. And, you know, there's a ton of, in the lean startup world, there's like all these stories about like, yeah, this company started and they were doing this thing. And it's like, I think Slack is one of those stories. You know, the Slack messaging app. Mm-hmm. Do you know that story?
I don't know the story. I know the app.
I think like they got investors. They were building like, I think a game. And then they were having to like manage their product. And they created this messaging thing to like manage their development. And then that ended up becoming, hey, this is actually a better thing. So it's something to that effect. But there's all these kinds of stories in the lean startup community where it's like you ship all this stuff and then people don't like most of it. I don't know.
You see that in so many different ways? Like, big companies, and you go back to the roots, and you go, oh, the steel manufacturer was once a sewing machine company.
Yeah. Right.
So you know somewhere along the way, it's not necessarily a product adaptation, but it's market adaptation. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's seeing that what we're providing isn't going to be needed, so we niche down or transition.
Yeah. So first question is, how do you know if it's time to pivot versus you need to persevere?
I'd say it probably depend on feedback from the market, right? So this is why talking to customers and stuff is such a big deal, so that if you are constantly getting a feedback about, oh, I love this feature, or I would like this thing added, or I don't like that thing, then you kind of take them, because the market's so huge and you're so ignorant of most of it that you can't really guess 100% to start. You know, so hopefully you know, as you go, you get that feedback. They'll tell you what product they need, and then you pivot, hopefully get closer to that, and then you'll be wrong, and then they'll give you more feedback, and then you'll change it, and then eventually get closer to what they really need.
I wonder how the level of the niche that you're trying to reach, the people, plays into that. Because there might be something that's wonderful for a very small percentage of the population, and it will be the go-to for those people. So it becomes the number one, no competitors, there's a great moat because, you know, all of the things about not being able to take over, that could be a great thing. But how do you find them? You know, that would be another thing. Versus a product that is number 10 on the list of preference, but it appeals to a millions of people. So you don't have to be number one to have the same outcome. So I wonder how the focus versus breadth plays into, do I press in or do I adjust? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and then to your point, I think it sounds like you're saying it should be data driven. Your pivot should be data driven, but there is sometimes pushback on that it should be intuition driven. Like the whole point of having a founder, a good founder, is someone who can make connections that nobody else is making. So like the case for that would be that, you know, the famous one is Henry Ford. If I had asked everyone what they wanted, they would say they wanted a faster buggy or chair, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But he was building a car, right? So the question is there a rule of thumb, or like, is there a way that like someone can learn, like, should it be data driven? Should it be intuition driven? Is there like guardrails around that you'd think? I mean, I have some ideas, but.
There's some assumptions that I'm processing.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe a general idea could be pivot so that you can pay for your passion.
Okay.
But if you pursue passion, you may never get to the point where you can actually pay for anything.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like the guy who is a great artist, mm-hmm. and he's a painter and he paints amazing murals, but he can't get a job doing that. So he's painting fences. And so he's paying the bills with painting the fences, but on the side, he's pursuing his passion until it catches on and people want that.
Okay.
Maybe that's a similar thing.
Well, I think kind of what you're getting at is that this is like a passion project, like where he's saying, hey, I've got this intuition. This isn't necessarily based on feedback. It's just a gut feeling, and I'm just going to keep going with it.
Yeah. If somebody's desire outcome is just the money,
mm-hmm.
well, then that's a different measure as far as what am I going to pursue. But if I have a passion thing, like I think this is going to change the world, and by the way, it's going to throw off a bunch of money, but you can't afford to live, you're going to have to pivot to pay the bills until you can pursue it. So I wonder if people with a lot of money have the resources to just throw money at a passion, hoping that it's going to be the thing that catches fire.
Yeah.
Well, I think that entrepreneurs start with intuition, right? That's why they want to build the thing they want to build, because mm-hmm. they have this feeling that I think this is a problem in the market. I think this is something people would like. This seems to connect with these two things. But intuition isn't perfect, and it's not necessarily true. And so then you have to go validate that intuition and see if that's an actual thing. And then I think that's where the data comes into it, to refine your intuition, because it's too broad of a thing, and the market's a much more specific thing. So your intuition's probably right that this is a need. It's just probably wrong as to how exactly to solve that problem.
Yeah. So here's how I would approach it. Like, and I'm curious if you guys would agree with this, but I think you cannot pivot too fast potentially. Mm. And so when I say you can't pivot too fast, I mean, you make a pivot, you get it out in the market and see how people respond to it. I think immediately you should start planning your next pivot, and you should be putting something else out there. And I think that this is, it's all going to get you data points. Like I know a venture capital firm that literally rose their seed, or well, I guess you call it a fund, right? To do seed investing into early stage startups. And their whole thesis was, we don't even care about what their product is. We just want to know, do they have a system to pivot very quickly? And if they could give someone an 18-month runway and they were going to pivot once a week, they had faith that if these founders are good, they can be pivoting once a week. They're going to make like 70, 80 pivots in that 18 months. And the chances that they're going to pivot into product market fit are very high. Whereas there's a lot of companies that pivot once a month, 18-month runway, you only get 18 pivots. Chances that you're going to pivot into the right product are not very likely. So
well, what do they consider a pivot? I mean, is it just like, oh, we were working on this app and we think we should make it red instead of blue? Is that a pivot?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how they define pivot, and I think that it is kind of an ambiguous term. I think basically when I'm thinking about it, it's maybe that is a pivot, right? But I think basically you just look at the feedback that you're getting and decide to make a change. And so how big the change is or how small, I don't think matters as much as is just the practice of getting the feedback, taking in the data, and making changes off of that. I think you could probably just brute force it. Like, if you're making enough pivots, eventually you're going to stumble into the right product market fit.
I guess to me, if a pivot something small like that, it's inevitable that you're constantly making those pivots, you know? But when I think of a pivot, I think of it like the Slack example you described, where we're doing this thing, and we've kind of decided that now we're going to do this messaging thing. Like, that's a huge, like, shift in what your goals are and all that kind of stuff and what you're working on. And so I guess I think of it as a bigger change, you know. So if you're doing that every week, it's like, that's a disaster. You can't do that. But if it's just little, like, tweaks and minor modifications, and that's a pivot, then I would think that would just kind of be a necessary feature.
Yeah, I mean, technically, I guess some people call those iterations.
Iterations, yeah. Sure, yeah.
And then the pivots are for the bigger ones. So, but yeah, I think the other thing that's interesting, if we're going to talk about like the difference between should it be data-driven or intuition-driven, I think it's a healthy mix of both. And what I think is that if you're doing it correctly, what you're doing is you're gathering data in a structured way where you're actually trying to bias the people away from, you know, liking your product. So then that way, if they do like something, you want to reduce false positives. So it's like, hey, like, we're not sure this feature is going to work out good. And if people are like, no, we love this feature, and you've biased them away from it, then it's like, okay, this is, people are liking it. But I don't think that's enough. If whether they're liking it or not liking it, I don't think you take their advice on where to pivot. I think you take their advice on, well, why do you like this? What is it doing? Why? Keep asking why until it becomes obvious. The deeper you get, you start to understand the motivations. And once you understand those motivations, then you use your own intuition and your knowledge in the space to make connections that other people might not make about what the right way to actually move forward is. So I think there's a mix there. I think you do need to rely on your own intuition for what the feature should be and the right makeup of the crappy, smelly product. But I think that the way to be successful is that needs to be data driven into understanding the why of what the people are trying to actually accomplish, the pain.
Are we talking about a company that already is selling a product or pre-stage? Because we talked about MVP.
Yeah.
And so are we at the stage where these companies are getting actual money, or they're still pre-launch type of thing? Because I think it would be different, because if you're an established, you know, you're already trying to sell the product to the market, then I think basically you just, the money decides, you know, and that's your data, basically. Mm-hmm. If nobody wants to buy it, then you have to pivot to something else. And until the money shows up, you don't really have anything. So that's kind of how I think about it. The money is really the data. The customer feedback is kind of useless until they give you their money.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say you're starting to get money. Does that mean you stop pivoting once you're getting money?
I mean, it would be, yeah. I mean, not necessarily, because unless it's a lot of money, then you know you got something.
Yeah.
But if it's just a trickle, then it's probably not, you're probably still not where you need to be.
Well, I would go back to the idea of if it's bringing in enough to pay for itself and throw off money, now you're golden because you can keep that product going and not iterate as far as public facing behind the scenes and continue to iterate in new ways, spin stuff off. You know, then you don't have any pressure to not to work under the gun of not having any money.
Mm-hmm.
So it frees you up to do those things. And I think part of it is sometimes people's initial reactions to a product or an iteration or whatever it might be may not be as positive as you want, because there's maybe a higher threshold of user interface acceptance. So like initially, this is uncomfortable for me. I switched from having an iOS or from a regular Android to an iOS. And initially, it's not easy because it's not intuitive. They say it's intuitive. Well, it might be until you're trained in a different system. And now all of a sudden it isn't intuitive. So it took me a while to get into it. But once I got into that interface, it was helpful because I had a MacBook at home. I have a computer, a Mac on my desktop, and I have an iPhone. So does that make sense? Like, so sometimes the initial step through, if you're just interacting with people and saying, what's your initial reaction to this thing? It may not be everything. So maybe that's part of the push through to get past that initial response.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about some of the biases that are at play here. The sunk cost fallacy. We've already spent 2 years on this. We can't change now. Kind of, you know, so you've got that at play. A lot of times you have ego bias. You kind of mistake your stubbornness for grit. Like, you know, you don't want to, if you've told a bunch of people, this is what we're doing, and then you want to keep your ego intact. Shiny object syndrome. This is probably one that I fall. It's like, oh, every time something new feels exciting. I mean, you get to a point where it's like your product feels old to you. Maybe other people don't know.
So you're looking for pivots and iterations, even though they're unnecessary.
Yeah. You're looking for like, oh, how can we make this even better? And then nobody else has even gotten to the first step, right? Survivorship bias, only hearing, only paying attention to the pivots that worked, not the ones that flopped. And so that bias is at play, affecting people as they pivot. So some thought experiments here. If Slack's game had actually launched, would they still have found the chat pivot? They never launched their game. And so like, would they, so this is kind of the idea of, it relates to what you're saying about like, hey, once you've got this point where you're profitable, now you've got all this freedom. Slack, like the counter to that is necessity is the mother of invention, right? And so like Slack kind of had to, like, their game wasn't launching. They were in trouble. Then they pivoted into this thing. So
I wonder if a couple people on their team were sad that they weren't creating a game. So once they were successful, you say, hey, you two sad people, keep chasing the game, you know, on the side.
Well, making a game sounds a lot more fun than making a messaging app.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know?
If Netflix had stayed DVD only, you know, would someone else have invented streaming first, or would have they pivoted into that? What's worse, pivoting away from something that might have worked or refusing to pivot from something that clearly isn't working?
Sorry, say that again.
What's worse, the bigger mistake as a founder, pivoting away from something that might have worked or refusing to pivot from something that isn't working?
I think personality plays into that some. Like, if you're somebody that is a risk taker, that is... willing to, you know, bet on something because you believe, then it would, it's the loss aversion.
Yeah.
So like the after effect, I might regret one choice over the other, depending on my own personality. And I think that's an interesting take. If the measure of if it's worse is, does it financially play out? There's no way to know.
Yeah.
I think the refusing to pivot would be the worst one.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
I think that was, yeah, I agree with that. What do you think of the idea of having a pivot quota just to kind of like keep pushing it along? Like, I need to make 70 pivots. So, like, is that going to keep the pace long enough or better than just pivoting when it feels like it makes sense?
Will it force me to make pivots that are unhelpful because I have to meet a quota?
Probably. But is that less of a risk than if you just pivot when you feel like it, that you might not pivot enough or when needed? What do you think? Pivot quota? I think a pivot quota is probably, as a general practice, like if you can get 70 pivots in, I don't know.
For me, it feels like multiple levels. If you just say you have to get the minimum, some people are driven to meet the minimum. But if I'm driven to meet the minimum, but then I get some kind of bonus for quality of pivot or bonus for high-level quantity of pivots, but just meeting a minimum, I think, might feed into the wrong motivation of,
yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Minimal effort for maximum gain.
Cool. So last thing we'll discuss here is if we're going to create an environment that leverages our biases to make it more conducive for us to be pivoting in a healthy way, the biases that it recommends here, pre-commitment. So a lot of these are going to sound familiar. Like the idea is you set a rule like, if I don't see traction within X number of days, like 90 days, I pivot, pre-commitment to change. So it's not just emotional. Default bias strategy, you know, run pivot experiments as the default next step when you hit metric plateaus, rather than only when panic sets in. Social proof, you could leverage that to share pivot options publicly with your community or mastermind. Loss aversion, reframe sticking with a dead idea is losing time, money. Pivoting is persevering. And then the fresh start effect, tie pivots to natural resets, new quarter, new fiscal year, new accelerator cohort, like, hey, we're going to make a pivot when we do these things. So this one's a little bit more nuanced, I think. But I mean, I guess the question is, what is the biggest takeaway that you can think of for, like, if you were going to create an environment where you were in a pivot in the healthiest way possible, what would that environment look like? What kind of changes would you make to your environment? Like, would you say, okay, I'm going to give myself a pivot quota. Am I going to pivot every month? Am I going to pivot every week, make one meaningful pivot? Am I going to do, you know, commit to other people that I'm going to pivot? What would be any ideas on what you would do to create an environment that's going to lead you to pivot more often?
I think one of the dangers of, and I'm not answering that directly, but I am answering it indirectly. One of the dangers of over pivoting is you have lots of little things, but you're not built on anything. Like if you keep chipping away at the foundation, then you don't have anything to build on. So figuring out what iterations or what pivots are building on what you've already learned, doesn't have to be the product, but something you've already learned, instead of, I need to change this because it's time to change it. And you've tweaked everything you understand to tweak, but you haven't gained enough data to know what to tweak. And so now I'm changing something that's chipping away at the foundation instead of something else. So I'm creating dust bunnies instead of building something. But I don't know what that is. I think one of the tools, I think, is, I don't have a word for it. I'll say it feeds into loss aversion. And that would be if I had the iteration, to pivot, if I had the other thing mm-hmm. and I was considering going to what I have now,
yep.
would I do that? Because then you're losing what could have been instead of losing what is. So it's feeding into that, the buy-in, you've already invested so much. What's mm-hmm. that called when you don't want to?
Sunk cost.
Yeah, sunk cost. So I think it feeds into the sunk cost, or is a reframing of sunk cost and loss aversion. So I don't know if that's a thing. Maybe part of what I would do for myself is create a routine where here are some things that I want to do every so often. I want to reframe it. I want to reverse engineer my thought process. I want to think through loss aversion, fear of loss, and I want to think about sunk costs, but think of it from reverse and maybe use that as a tool. Yeah. So instead of saying I have to pivot, say I have to go through the process of thinking about what the pivot might be.
Yeah. So it's almost like you give yourself a list of things, and then like maybe every week you run your thing through like, hey, how am I doing here? How am I doing here? Is it time for a pivot?
Yeah, I like that. I like give myself every week I have to think through. It either can be a feature or the thing itself mm-hmm. that I want to run through this, and then I will intentionally force myself to choose a pivot. That so it's both. It's I give myself a time frame to think about it, but a time frame to do it as well. Because I'm a little cautious about just making pivots because I have to make a pivot instead of doing something that's actually going to move me forward.
Yeah, I would be concerned about people making pivots that aren't actually helpful or useful or whatever. Or making, like, for example, a pivot might be, oh, we need to add this feature. Mm-hmm. Well, they just want to add features because they think that's fun, so they're going to call that a pivot or whatever. The pivoting probably should be eliminating things that are unnecessary. But I don't know. I guess I don't really like the quota idea or sort of scheduling these things, because I think that there is more intuition kind of involved. And so I think if you can maybe, if you have a group of people that are kind of more intuitive and you can sort of run things past each other, I think you could probably come up with a good pivot that would make sense. But pivoting for the sake of pivoting doesn't seem real useful, I guess,
yeah.
or productive.
No, this has been good for me. Here's my takeaway. Here's what I would do, because I like what you were saying. I like the idea of a quota, but it wouldn't be a quota for how many pivots I get. It would be a quota of I need to get 30 pieces of feedback. Then once I've achieved 30 pieces of feedback, then I'm going to run an analysis on how, like, what was liked, what was not liked, and make a decision on whether or not a pivot is necessary or if I should go into more feedback, right? So, like, what you would do is, like, your quota would be for not necessarily I need to make a pivot by this amount of time. I need to have this many pieces of feedback, and then I need to analyze it, and then, like, maybe some metric for if the negative sentiment or I'm not making enough money for it to be profitable, then that would say, okay, well, we need to make a pivot based off of this feedback. Here's our best thing. Or if you're making enough money, maybe you don't need to make a pivot. Maybe you focus on marketing or something else, like, to amplify, right? So that still has a quota, but the quota is not saying I need to make a pivot. The quota is the process I'm going to go through is collecting enough data, making an educated decision, and then moving forward and collecting new data. So if the decision's not a pivot in product, it probably needs to be a pivot in marketing. Or like, so it's almost like maybe you are making a pivot either way. I don't know. I'm just trying to talk through it.
No, I like that idea. I like the idea of the quota on the feedback. That makes a lot of sense. Because then you're making an informed pivot.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just, I kind of feel like maybe this is what we should do. And then you're probably wrong, you know?
Well, I love the idea of combining the idea of structure. Structure can be quota, schedule, once a week, once a month, number of feedback, all of those things. Those are structural. It's like a trellis. I think I might have used this before, where a trellis is necessary for the vine to grow on. It's not the intuition. It's not the passion. It's not the thing that brings life to the product, but you have to have something for the life to grow on. Otherwise, it just is on the ground, and it really doesn't achieve what it ultimately can. So it's kind of a combination of how do I shape my environment, which is the trellis,
yeah,
so that my intuition and creativity has someplace to grow effectively.
You love bringing up trellis.
I do. This is like the third time.
Do you know what a trellis is now?
I do know what it is now. It's not a tralala. I remember
tra-la-la,
that.
Tralala. Yeah. I do love that.
It makes you so
giddy.
It's
the yin and yang. It's the whatever.
I've just been thinking, like, now I'm thinking, like, okay, because we were thinking about product pivots, but like, does it ever make sense? Now I'm thinking maybe you always should be pivoting in some way as a business, even if you're making money, because if you don't, then you're going to become the Blockbuster story,
mm-hmm.
right?
Or Kodak. Like,
what can we all agree that their problem was they didn't pivot as the market changed?
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
And part of the problem is you can grow as a company in a dying industry, because if everybody else who's smaller than you is dying off, you're gaining market share even though the market is shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
But then you end up being the last guy standing with all the market that dissolves. And I think that's kind of like a Blockbuster or a Kodak.
Yeah, so I think my epiphany here is you always should be pivoting. Like the cadence, or like call it a pivot, call it an iteration. Like you should be making changes to your business, whether it's the product or the marketing or the messaging, or something should be changing. Maybe employee count, like are we becoming more efficient? There should always be changes.
Mm.
And so those changes, so then the idea here that like maybe I could come up with after this is, here's the amount of feedback that you need to get from the end user. Once you've hit this, then you take that in and make a decision on, does the product need to pivot or iterate? Does the marketing or the efficiency of the company, something? But if you're not doing that, you're probably at more risk of stagnating. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, sure. I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And the bias of those who provide feedback, you know, I think companies by now would know that people don't like giving feedback, so they'd stop asking.
Yeah.
Because after everything, it's like, will you give feedback?
Mm-hmm.
How many people actually do? God. Not very many.
Makes me like the company less when I get asked. Every time I get asked to do it, it's like, I want to engage with that company less. Unless they're going to pay me or give me a discount on my next thing. I don't know. Do you guys ever like it?
I don't. There's ways that they ask that it makes me not want to use the company at all. There's other ways that don't make me feel like they're trying to guilt me or manipulate me into doing it.
Yeah. Even when they offer me money, I don't do it, you know, or it's like, you know, $5 or whatever. If you take this, I'm like, nah,
yeah,
you know, like, but if I really like a product, then I will do it. You know, cause I'm like, okay, I like this company. I want to help them out because I thought I was impressed with what I bought. I didn't expect it to be as good as it was.
Mm.
So I gladly give
maybe that's
feedback.
The feedback that's most helpful is how many people actually do the feedback, whether or not, you know, if it's terrible. But if people like it and they feedback, then if I'm getting 10% response and most of it's positive, then that means a lot of people are loving this
probably
thing
a lot,
instead of 1% and everybody hates it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although I've heard that the people who are most likely to respond are those who are the least happy with a whatever it might be. So when you hear lots of negative feedback, it might not be that it's terrible. It just means that the people who really don't like it are really loud.
Yeah. Well, I was going to end it, but now I've got to...
Sorry, I took us off into another tangent.
Well, my question is, we all hate giving feedback.
And now we're suggesting that it's important for us to pursue it, even though nobody wants to give it.
Yeah. I guess when I think about feedback, I don't necessarily mean it's a survey or something, you know. So, like, I get feedback constantly from tenants and stuff like that, you know. But it's not, I'm not asking them, hey, what do you think about X, Y, and Z? It's like they're complaining about something, or they, you know, don't want to pay a certain amount for a certain thing, or they want a whole bunch of this thing, or, you know, like that kind of feedback. So that would be more, I guess, what I'm talking about. I don't think many people really like doing surveys.
Yeah. You know? So if your product is not resonating and you're not getting good results, don't send them a survey. Do what? Like, what do you do to get that feedback?
Well, I think that's why the money is, that's why I was wondering if we were talking about companies making money or not, because money is the feedback for a company. And so if they aren't buying what you're selling, that's the best feedback you can get.
Yep.
You know, and so
that tells you what's wrong. It doesn't tell you, it doesn't give you the why or insights behind what needs to change. So how do you get to those insights? Surveys is what is people's go-to. Is there a different way?
Well, now with all the AI, and people can track who bought it, and then they can say, oh, this is bought by a guy who's 40, between 40 and 50, whose median income is this, who lives, you know, 40 minutes from a major city hub. I mean, they can now do those sorts of things. So that provides, I think that's what data is so valuable, because it's feedback without having to ask somebody a question. You're gaining the information. And if you're like, wow, that's not the people we were aiming for, how can we better market to them instead of the housewife that's working in the inner city? Like, oh, we need to change our marketing, or adapt our product so it's not pink, so it's like blue or whatever. So I don't know if it's, I mean, that's feedback, but it's data-driven feedback based on who's buying it and what the price points are.
Let me ask you this. I wonder if the survey is frustrating to us because of the structure of it, and it's just kind of not fun to go through a survey, or whether it is the actual labor of giving the feedback. Because I like, if imagine if there was a way to just say, you know, frustrated, vent here, and then you could just like press the thing. This stupid thing sucks because of this, this, this. Like, if you could just talk like that and not have to be like, tell me what you thought about this and like this. And it's like, it feels like, well, that's not even what I was frustrated about. And you're asking me these questions. Like, instead of asking them that, like, if you hit on an emotional pain point, I wonder if there's a way that you could embed in your experience, vent here, free form, give us all, like, you know, roast us, you know?
Yeah.
If you could do it in that way, I wonder if that would be, I feel like that would be a significantly better way to get actual feedback at the point where they're frustrated.
I think you've tapped into something, making it so it doesn't look like something else, but it's an experience. I'm not just somebody who's providing data or clicking on radio buttons or giving a number or whatever. I'm having an experience of either being able to vent with frustration, or here's a color wheel. How does what color represents the product? You know, the way that you feel when you hit the product. What do you do with that? I don't know, but at least it gives the person an experiential response. Why did you pick that color?
Yeah.
Well, because when I was a kid, you know, whatever. And you're like, oh, it reminds you of your child. So it's giving you feedback, but it's more of an experience than just, you know, data.
Yeah.
I like that. That's cool.
I don't know. I mean, I think the feedback's a tough thing.
Yeah.
Because it's, people have so much going on, and they, you know, it's just a delete this email kind of thing, you know. So is the feedback going to be of a high enough quality to even mess with, you know? But, you know, the thing I hate is when it's an email and it's, oh, take this survey or whatever, and then it's like 25 questions or something. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way I'm doing that.
And there's a bar at the bottom that says, oh, you're 1% through, and you're like,
Okay, X.
You know what? Google Maps in an earlier version, I don't think it still has this, but did you guys know this? Like if you shook your phone, the gyro, whatever inside your phone would recognize it and it would send something to, like it had a trigger inside the app that would say, if someone just shook their phone, they're probably mad. And it would ask you, yeah, it would ask you, hey, are you having a bad experience? Tell me about it. It had that in there. I don't know if it's still in there. I could try shaking it, but I remember.
That's a good idea. Integrated into the product.
Yeah. But so, yeah.
Their temperature's going up. Their palms getting sweaty.
Mom's spaghetti.
People are yelling louder. Yeah, it knows.
Yeah, I think I'm going to take that away. I think what I'm going to do is figure out, like, is there a better way to make it an experience to get that feedback and make it. So I think now that AI is here, you could just freeform, like just say something like, hey, if you're frustrated, click here to vent and to roast our app and we'll take in and ingest this and use it to make it better in the future. And if it was just left at that, you'd probably get.
Well, I think if you already have people using your product, like mm-hmm. if you have an app, for example, what do you think about just having every so often a pop-up or something that says enjoying your experience 1 through 5 or something? They just click nope, 1, 5, yes, and that's it, mm-hmm. you know? So I think you could integrate it into a product like that. If you already have a product, it's much harder to get the feedback from people that haven't used it or don't, you know?
Yeah.
And then when it's just like conceptual rather than if it's an actual thing.
Mm. Well, that gives people an opportunity to respond to the thing that's a problem. Mm-hmm. So if you're starting to see a whole bunch of things, people suggest that this is a bad experience and then to keep repeating the same thing, then you know, oh, we got to pay attention to that mm-hmm. thing. Reminds me of, maybe you've heard of this, that they had bathrooms. It was either an airport, I think it was an airport, or a stadium, and they just had a button on the wall that was red with an unhappy face and green with a happy face. Mm-hmm. And that's all there was as far as feedback. But if there's a whole bunch of unhappy faces, all of a sudden they knew because they had limited people to service them. And so instead of sending their bathroom custodians to every bathroom to check, they would just watch that. And then all of a sudden there's reds showing up. So they would send their people there. But that's a similar thing where if you just give people a simple feedback tool through the product, and so they're like mm-hmm. responding positive or negatively to whatever it might be, then you know that's where your attention needs to go. Yeah. Or, hey, this is green all the time. Let's really beef that thing up and lean into our positives.
Yeah. Cool, guys. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.